Chapter 5, Section 2. Savings in Labour Conditions at the Expense of the Labourers. 1. Coal Mines. Neglect of Indisputable Outlays. Quote, under the competition which exists among the coal owners and coal proprietors, no more outlay is incurred than is sufficient to overcome the most obvious physical difficulties. And under that which prevails among the labouring colliers, who are ordinarily more numerous than the work to be done requires, a large amount of danger and exposure to the most noxious influences will gladly be encountered for wages a little in advance of the agricultural population round them, in an occupation in which they can, moreover, make a profitable use of their children. This double competition is quite sufficient to cause a large proportion of the pits to be worked with the most imperfect drainage and ventilation, often with ill-constructed shafts, bad gearing, incompetent engineers, and ill-constructed and ill-prepared bays and roadways, causing a destruction of life and limb and health, the statistics of which would present an appalling picture. Unquote. First Report on Children's Employment in Mines and Collieries, etc., April 21, 1829. About 1860, a weekly average of 15 men lost their lives in the English collieries. According to the Report on Coal Mines Accidents, February the 6th, 1862, a total of 8,466 were killed in the 10 years 1852-61. But the report admits that this number is far too low, because in the first few years, when the inspectors had just been installed and their districts were far too large, a great many accidents and deaths were not reported. The very fact that the number of accidents, though still very high, has decreased markedly since the inspection system was established, and this in spite of the limited powers and insufficient numbers of the inspectors, demonstrates the natural tendency of capitalist exploitation. These human sacrifices are mostly due to the inordinate avarice of the mine owners. Very often they had only one shaft sunk, so that apart from the lack of effective ventilation, there was no escape were this shaft to become obstructed. Capitalist production, when considered in isolation from the process of circulation and the excesses of competition, is very economical with the materialized labor incorporated in commodities. Yet, more than any other mode of production, it squanders human lives, or living labor, and not only blood and flesh, but also nerve and brain. Indeed, it is only by dint of the most extravagant waste of individual development that the development of the human race is at all safeguarded and maintained in the epoch of history immediately preceding the conscious reorganization of society. Since all of the economizing here discussed arises from the social nature of labor, it is indeed just this directly social nature of labor which causes the waste of life and health. The following question, suggested by Factory Inspector R. Baker, is characteristic in this respect. Quote, the whole question is one for serious consideration, and in what way this sacrifice of infant life occasioned by congregational labour can best be averted. Unquote. Reports of the Inspector of Factories, October 1863. 2. Factories. Under this heading, there is covered the disregard for safety measures to ensure the security, comfort, and health of labourers also in the actual factories. It is to blame for a large portion of the casualty lists containing the wounded and killed industrial workers. See the annual factory reports. Similarly, lack of space, ventilation, etc. As far back as October 1855, Leonard Horner complained about the resistance of very many manufacturers to the legal requirements concerning safety devices on horizontal shafts. Although the danger was continually emphasized by accidents, many of them fatal, and although these safety devices did not cost much and did not interfere with production. Reports of Inspector of Factories, October 1855. In their resistance against these and other legal requirements, the manufacturers were openly seconded by the unpaid justices of the peace, who were themselves mostly manufacturers or friends of manufacturers, and handed down their decisions accordingly. What sort of verdicts these gentlemen handed down was revealed by Superior Judge Campbell, who said with reference to one of them, against which an appeal had been made to him, quote, "It is not an interpretation of the Act of Parliament, it is a repeal of the Act of Parliament." Unquote. Horner states in the same report that in many factories labourers are not warned when machinery is about to be started up. Since there is always something to be done about machinery, even when it is not operating, fingers and hands are always occupied with it, and accidents happen continually due to the mere omission of a warning signal. The manufacturers had a trades union at the time to oppose factory legislation, the so-called National Association for the Amendment of the Factory Laws in Manchester, which in March 1855 collected more than £50,000 by assessing 2 shillings per horsepower to pay for the court proceedings against its members started by factory inspectors, and to conduct the cases in the name of the union. In an allusion to the pamphlet Killing No Murder, which appeared in England in 1657 by the leveller Edward Sexby, it was a matter of proving that killing was no murder when it occurred for the sake of profit. A factory inspector for Scotland, Sir John Kincaid, tells about a certain firm in Glasgow which used the iron scrap at its factory to make protective shields for all its machinery, the cost amounting to £9 1 shilling. Joining the manufacturers' union would have cost it an assessment of £11 for its 110 horsepower, which was more than the cost of all its protective appliances. But the National Association had been organized in 1854 for the express purpose of opposing the law which prescribed such protection. The manufacturers had not paid the least heed to it during the whole period from 1844 to 1854. When the factory inspectors, at instructions from Palmerston, then informed the manufacturers that the law would be enforced in earnest, the manufacturers instantly founded their association, many of whose most prominent members were themselves justices of the peace, and in this capacity were supposed to enforce the law. When, in April 1855, the new Minister of the Interior, Sir George Grey, offered a compromise under which the government would be content with practically nominal safety appliances, the association indignantly rejected even this. In various lawsuits, the famous engineer William Fairbairn threw the weight of his reputation behind the principle of economy and in defence of the freedom of capital, which had been violated. The head of factory inspection, Leonard Horner, was persecuted and maligned by the manufacturers in every conceivable manner. But the manufacturers did not rest until they obtained a writ of the Court of Queen's Bench, according to which the law of 1844 did not prescribe protective devices for horizontal shafts installed more than 7 feet above the ground, and, finally, in 1856 they succeeded in securing an Act of Parliament entirely satisfactory to them in the circumstances through the services of the bigot Wilson Paton, one of those pious souls whose display of religion is always ready to do the dirty work for the Knights of the Moneybag. This act practically deprived the labourers of all special protection, and referred them to the common courts for compensation in the event of industrial accidents. Sheer mockery, in view of the excessive cost of English lawsuits. While it made it almost impossible for the manufacturer to lose the lawsuit by providing in a finely worded clause for expert testimony. The result was a rapid increase of accidents. In the 6 months, from May to October 1858, Inspector Baker reported that accidents increased by 21% compared with the preceding half-year. In his opinion, 36.7% of these accidents might have been avoided. It is true that the number of accidents in 1858 and 1859 was considerably below that of 1845 and 1846. It was actually 29% less, although the number of labourers in the industries subject to inspection had increased by 20%. But what was the reason for this? Insofar as this issue has been settled now, 1865, it was mainly accomplished through the introduction of new machinery already provided with safety devices, to which the manufacturer did not object because they cost him no extra expense. Furthermore, a few labourers succeeded in securing heavy damages for their lost arms, and had this judgment upheld even by the highest courts. Reports of the Inspector of Factories, April the 30th, 1861. Ditto, April 1862. So much for economy in devices, protecting the life and limbs of labourers, among whom many children, against the dangers of handling and operating machinery. 3. Work in enclosed places generally. It is well known to what extent economy of space, and thus of buildings, crowds labourers into close quarters. In addition, there is also economy in means of ventilation. Coupled with the long working hours, the two cause a large increase in diseases of the respiratory organs, and an attendant increase in the death rate. The following illustrations have been taken from Reports on Public Health, 6th Report, 1863. This report was compiled by Dr. John Simon, well known from our Volume 1. Just as combination and cooperation of labour permits large-scale employment of machinery, concentration of means of production, and economy in their use, it is this very working together en masse in enclosed places and under conditions rather determined by ease of manufacture than by health requirements, it is this mass concentration in one and the same workshop that acts on the one hand as a source of greater profits for the capitalist, and on the other, unless counteracted by a reduced number of hours and special precautions, as the cause of the squandering of the lives and health of the labourers. Dr. Simon formulates the following rule, and backs it up with abundant statistics. Quote, "In proportion as the people of a district are attracted to any collective indoor occupation, in such proportion, other things being equal, the district death rate by lung diseases will be increased. The cause is bad ventilation, and probably in all England there is no exception to the rule that, in every district which has a large indoor industry, the increased mortality of the workpeople is such as to colour the death return of the whole district with a marked excess of lung disease." Unquote. Mortality figures for industries carried on in enclosed places, collected by the Board of Health in 1860 and 1861, indicate that for the same number of men between the ages of 15 and 55, for which the death rate from consumption and other pulmonary diseases in English agricultural districts is 100, the death rate in Coventry is 163, in Blackburn and Skipton, 167, Congleton and Bradford, 168, Leicester, 171, Leek, 182, Macclesfield, 184, Bolton, 190, Nottingham, 192, Rochdale, 193, Derby, 198, Salford and Ashton-under-Lyne, 203, Leeds, 218, Preston, 220, and Manchester, 263. The following figures present a still more striking illustration. They show the death rate for pulmonary diseases separately for both sexes between the ages of 15 and 25, computed for every 100,000 population. In the districts and industries selected, only women are employed in enclosed places, while men work in all other possible lines. Berkhamsted, straw plaiting, men 219, women 578. Leighton Buzzard, straw plaiting, men 309, women 554. Newport Pagnell, lace manufacture, men 301, women 617. Toaster, lace manufacture, men 239, women 577. Yeovil, manufacture of gloves, men 280, women 409. Leek, silk industry, men 437, women 856. Congleton, silk industry, men 566, women 790. Macclesfield, silk industry, men 593, women 890. Healthy country district, agriculture, men 331, women 333. In the silk districts, where more men are employed in the factory, their mortality is also higher. The death rate from consumption, etc., for both sexes reveals, as the report says, quote, the atrocious sanitary circumstances under which much of our silk industry is conducted, unquote. And it is in this same silk industry that the manufacturers, pleading exceptionally favourable and sanitary conditions in their establishments, demanded by way of an exception, and partially obtained, long working hours for children under 13 years of age. Capital, Volume 1, Chapter 10. Quote, probably no industry which has yet been investigated has afforded a worse picture than that which Dr. Smith gives of tailoring. Shops vary much in their sanitary conditions, but almost universally are overcrowded and ill-ventilated, and in a high degree unfavourable to health. Such rooms are necessarily warm, but when the gas is lit, as during the daytime on foggy days, and at night during the winter, the heat increases to 80 degrees, and even to upwards of 90 degrees, causing profuse perspiration and condensation of vapour upon the panes of glass, so that it runs down in streams or drops from the roof, and the operatives are compelled to keep some windows open at whatever risk to themselves of taking cold. And he gives the following account of what he found in 16 of the most important West End shops. The largest cubic space in these ill-ventilated rooms allowed to each operative is 270 feet, and the least 105 feet, and in the whole averages only 156 feet per man. In one room, with a gallery running round it, and lighted only from the roof, from 92 to upwards of 100 men are employed, where a large number of gaslights burn. And where the urinals are in the closest proximity, the cubic space does not exceed 150 feet per man. In another room, which can only be called a kennel in a yard, lighted from the roof and ventilated by a small skylight opening, 5 to 6 men work in a space of 112 cubic feet per man. Tailors, in those atrocious workshops which Dr. Smith describes, work generally for about 12 or 13 hours a day, and at some times the work will be continued for 15 or 16 hours, unquote. It must be noted, and has in fact been remarked by John Simon, chief of the medical department and author of the report, that the mortality rate for tailors, typesetters, and printers of London between the ages of 25 and 35 was cited lower than the real figure, because London employers, in both lines of business, have a large number of young people, probably up to 30 years of age, from the country, engaged as apprentices and improvers, that is, men getting additional training. These swell the number of hands for which the London industrial death rates are computed. But they do not proportionally contribute to the number of deaths in London, because their stay there is only temporary. If they fall ill during this period, they return to their homes in the country, where their death is registered if they die. This circumstance affects the earlier ages still more, and renders the London death rates for these age groups completely valueless as indexes of the ill effects of industry on health. The case of the typesetters is similar to that of the tailors. In addition to lack of ventilation, to poisoned air, etc., there is still night work to be mentioned. Their regular working time is 12 to 13 hours, sometimes 15 to 16. Quote, great heat and foulness which begin when the gas jets are lit. It not infrequently happens that fumes from a foundry or foul odours from machinery or sinks rise from the lower room and aggravate the evils of the upper one. The heated air of the lower rooms always tends to heat the upper by warming the floor, and when the rooms are low and the consumption of gas great, this is a serious evil, and one only surpassed in the case where the steam boilers are placed in the lower room and supply unwished-for heat to the whole house. As a general expression, it may be stated that universally the ventilation is defective and quite insufficient to remove the heat and the products of the combustion of gas in the evening and during the night, and that in many offices, and particularly in those made from dwelling houses, the condition is most deplorable. And in some offices, especially those of weekly newspapers, there will be work too, in which boys between 12 and 16 years of age take equal part of, or almost uninterrupted periods of 2 days and a night at a time. While in other printing offices, which lay themselves out for the doing of urgent business, Sunday gives no relaxation to the workman, and his working days become 7 instead of 6 in every week. Unquote. The number of persons employed in agriculture in England and Wales is nearly 1 million. In tailoring in London, 22,000 men and 12,000 women. In typesetting and printing in London, 14,000. The death rate per 100,000 between the ages of 25 to 35, 743 in agriculture, 958 in tailoring, 894 in typesetting and printing. Between the ages of 35 and 45, 805 in agriculture, 1,262 in tailoring, 1,747 in typesetting and printing. Between the ages of 45 and 55, 1,145 in agriculture, 2,093 in tailoring, and 2,367 in typesetting and printing. The milliners and dressmakers have already attracted our attention in Volume 1, Chapter 10, in respect to overwork. Their workshops are described in our report by Dr. Ord. even if better during the day, they become overheated, foul, and unhealthy during the hours in which gas is burned. Dr. Ord found in 34 shops of the better sort that the average number of cubic feet per worker was as follows. Quote, in 4 cases, more than 500. In 4 other cases, from 400 to 500. In 7 others, from 200 to 250. In 4 others, from 150 to 200. And in 9 others, only from 100 to 150. The largest of these allowances would but be scanty for continuous work, unless the space were thoroughly well ventilated, and, except with extraordinary ventilation, its atmosphere could not be tolerably wholesome during gaslight. Unquote. And here is Dr. Ord's remark about one of the minor workshops which he visited, operated for the account of a middleman. Quote, one room area in cubical feet, 1,280. Persons present, 14. Area to each in cubical feet, 91.5. The women here were weary-looking and squalid. Their earnings were stated to be 7 shillings to 15 shillings a week, and their tea. Hours, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. The small room into which these 14 persons were crowded was ill-ventilated. There were 2 movable windows and a fireplace, but the latter was blocked up, and there was no special ventilation of any kind. Unquote. The same report states, with reference to the overwork of milliners and dressmakers, quote, the overwork of the young women in fashionable dressmaking establishments does not, for more than about 4 months of the year, prevail in that monstrous degree which has on many occasions excited momentary public surprise and indignation. But for the indoor hands during these months, it will, as a rule, be of full 14 hours a day, and will, when there is pressure, be for days together of 17 or even 18 hours. At other times of the year, the work of the indoor hands ranges probably from 10 to 14 hours, and uniformly the hours for outdoor hands are 12 or 13. For mantle makers, collar makers, shirt makers, and various other classes of needle workers, including persons who work at the sewing machine, the hours spent in the common workroom are fewer, generally not more than 10 to 12 hours. But, says Dr. Ord, the regular hours of work are subject to considerable extension in certain houses at certain times, by the practice of working extra hours for extra pay, and in other houses, by the practice of taking work away from houses of business to be done after hours at home. Both practices being, it may be added, often compulsory. Unquote. John Simon remarks in a footnote to this page, quote, Mr. Radcliffe, the Honorary Secretary of the Epidemiological Society, happening to have unusual opportunities for questioning the young women employed in first-class houses of business, has found that in only 1 out of 20 girls examined, who called themselves quite well, could the state of health be pronounced good, the rest exhibiting in various degrees evidences of depressed physical power, nervous exhaustion, and numerous functional disorders thereupon dependent. He attributes these conditions in the first place to the length of the hours of work, the minimum of which he estimates at 12 hours a day out of the season, and secondarily to crowding and bad ventilation of workrooms, gas vapours, insufficiency or bad quality of food, and inattention to domestic comfort. Unquote. The conclusion arrived at by the chief of the English Board of Health is that, quote, it is practically impossible for workpeople to insist upon that which in theory is their first sanitary right, the right that whatever work their employer assembles them to do shall, so far as depends upon him, be at his cost, divested of all needlessly unwholesome circumstances. While workpeople are practically unable to exact that sanitary justice for themselves, they also, notwithstanding the presumed intentions of the law, cannot expect any effectual assistance from the appointed administrators of the Nuisances Removal Acts. Doubtless, there may be some small technical difficulty in defining the exact line at which employers shall become subject to regulation, but, in principle, the sanitary claim is universal. And in the interest of myriads of labouring men and women, whose lives are now needlessly afflicted and shortened by the infinite physical suffering which their mere employment engenders, I would venture to express my hope that universally the sanitary circumstances of labour may, at least so far, be brought within appropriate provisions of law, that the effective ventilation of all indoor workplaces may be ensured, and that in every naturally insalubrious occupation the specific health-endangering influence may, as far as practicable, be reduced. Unquote.